Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today's Wednesday, February 4th. Thank you very much for being here. As you can see, we're absent a couple of members, but we're going to go ahead and get started. The first thing we have on our agenda is work session for possible introduction of committee measures. So the chair is going to go ahead and move for the following LCs to be introduced as committee bills. LC 890, dated 9-15-2014. LC 2914, dated 1-5-2015. LC 2916, dated 1-7-2015. LC 2837, dated 1-28-2015. LC 3154, dated 1-22-2015. So, I'm there. All right. So, with the chair's motion on this, I just do want to make certain that everyone understands, as our qualifying statement says on my blue sheet, a vote in favor of introducing the legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is does not indicate that the member's opinion or position on the contents of the concept. Basically, what we're saying here is that this is a means to allow for bills to be introduced through a committee. I do not expect anyone who favors this motion is going to be necessarily favoring their passage at some point in the future, even if they do or don't get a hearing, because there's no guarantee that they're one coming to our committee or two, whoever's committee they come to, is going to even schedule them for any type of legislative action. So with that, is any objection to the motion the chair has made? Not seeing or hearing any, so ordered. And we'll go ahead and close the work session for introduction of committee bills. And what we're going to do now is start our informational meeting. We have first informational meeting. It's going to be from the overview from the Oregon State Bar. And so we'll go ahead and open up informational hearing for that purpose. And Travis, I see that you're here today. Thank you very much. And whoever else you might want to bring with you, feel free to do so. Or if you want to leave your lifelines in the back, we can always call on them as needed.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for that. Yes, I'm here all by myself today, at least in terms of introducing the bar and what it does. As you know, my name is Travis Preswich. I'm a lawyer that practices here in Salem in a small plaintiff's firm. And it's a pleasure for me to be here to introduce you, those that may not know very well, to the Oregon State Bar. The Oregon State Bar is a public corporation and an instrumentality of the Judicial Department with nearly 15,000 active practicing members. The bar licenses and disciplines lawyers and performs other functions that are a benefit to the public. The bar does not receive any direct financial support in terms of tax dollars from the general fund, but is funded entirely by members' dues and other service programs. The bar has an executive director who oversees approximately 100 staff members, not including the professional liability fund. As far as governance is concerned, the bar is governed by the Board of Governors. It's an 18-member body, four of them being public members that are appointed, and the other 14 are elected members from various regions that are divided geographically throughout the state. Those of us that serve, all 18 of us that serve on that Board of Governors, do so on a volunteer basis without any compensation. The bar also has a House of Delegates, which is a representative assembly of membership that votes on proposed rules, dues, and policies, and basically helps set policy direction for the bar. There's approximately 230 delegates that comprise the House of Delegates. Now, the Oregon State Bar is a unique entity as compared to other states. First of all, it's the only bar in the country that allows public access to disciplinary complaint files from the time that the complaint is filed with the bar. And as you know, the disciplinary system is what keeps lawyers in check. It's the only state that has a mandatory malpractice coverage, and that is done through the Professional Liability Fund, which is a self-insuring entity. The Oregon State Bar has a great deal of public member involvement, both in terms of the Board of Governors, but also in involving public members in the various disciplinary processes, and also they are allowed to serve on certain committees like the State Professional Responsibility Board, local investigation committees, as well as trial panels and the Unlawful Practice of Law Committee. Lawyers generally in Oregon are pretty good about giving voluntary service. Of the 41% of lawyers that responded to the survey about pro bono work, those lawyers give approximately 9 hours of pro bono work per month throughout their practice, and that does not include lawyers that work for legal aid or other sort of service entities. And I suspect that that number is pretty underreported based on lawyers that I know. Oregon also has something called the Campaign for Equal Justice, which is Oregon is one of the few states that has this nonprofit fundraising campaign to raise money for legal aid each year. Since 1991 and CEJ's inception, approximately $23 million have been raised. The goal for this year is to raise $1.2 million, and those dollars come from lawyers. In terms of legislative priorities for this session, the bar is in support of court funding, both in terms of assisting in the continued implementation of the e-court system, which by all accounts has been very successful so far. It was recently implemented here in Marion County, and since I practice here and am familiar with that, I think it's gone through extremely well, and I've heard from other lawyers that have said the same thing. Court funding also includes funding for court facilities. As you know, we have many courthouses throughout the state that are in quite a state of disrepair, and so we've been working to bring them up to code and provide a safe environment for our justice system. The second priority, or second on the list at least, is continued support for legal services for low-income individuals. This includes indigent defense. As you know, they have a constitutional right to have an attorney to represent them through the criminal justice system, but also in civil cases, which oftentimes consist of housing issues, domestic violence issues, and funding for legal aid. And then finally, each year the Oregon State Bar presents a law improvement package. And there are a number of proposals on that package this year, a few of which are proposals submitted by the Board of Governors, the governing board, but also proposals that come from what are called member sections. Lawyers, when they join the bar, have the option of joining a section for their particular practice area. Typically, those sections comprise members that work on both sides of an issue. And so proposals that come out of those sections generally are fixes in the law, things that need to be changed that both sides of an issue recognize and are essentially law improvement. And you're going to be hearing, I suspect, a couple of those today. In fact, we've got several members of the bar that are here to testify about those things. And I guess the last thing I would add in terms of the Oregon State Bar, in terms of how it's unique, is the generally collegial and cooperative nature that the bar has. I have friends that are lawyers in many other states, and I think Oregon is a unique place to practice law. Most lawyers get along pretty well. They try to represent their clients as best they can, but also work in a cooperative manner to help bring resolution to disputes. And it's our privilege to be of assistance to the legislature to provide input and insight on various legislative proposals. So thank you.
Thank you for the overview, Travis. Is there any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that, we're going to go ahead and close our informational hearing on the Oregon State Bar, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 368. Laura, if you'll give us the overview, please.
Absolutely. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 368 was brought to us by the request of the State Bar debtor-creditor section. We do have an amendment on this, a -1 amendment, and that amendment adds some clarifying language to distinguish between in rem and real property. We do have the paperwork for that -1 amendment, so the bill is ready to move. So judgment statutes underwent revisions between 2003 and 2007, which seems to have created some unintended consequences and interpretations of those statutes. And problems specifically emerged when state court judges included entry of a money judgment in judicial foreclosure cases. So Senate Bill 368 clarifies that a money judgment is not always required when such inclusion is inappropriate or contrary to law. It also outlines how and when a judgment creditor that requested a writ of execution may bid on a property to be sold. It specifies when a judgment creditor must make payment to a sheriff, and it mandates that the sheriff deliver recover proceeds of an execution sale to the court administrator.
Great. Thank you. Patrick, thank you for being here.
Yeah, Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning on this bill. I think the committee has been apprised of the substance of the bill very adequately here. I just wanted to mention that the...
Patrick, I do need you to put your full name on the record, please.
Sorry, this is Patrick Wade, attorney from Hirshner Hunter and Eugene, representing the Oregon State Bar today with regard to Senate Bill 368. The problem we have is that some courts are interpreting existing ORS 88.010 in a way that would mandate that a foreclosing creditor always include a money award in a judgment. And as pointed out, there are various circumstances where a money award would be inappropriate. For example, where the debtor has been discharged in bankruptcy, one doesn't want to violate the federal discharge injunction or the automatic stay in a case that's still pending. You also have circumstances where you have a deceased debtor and there's no probate pending. One should not have a money award because there's nobody against whom a money award can be enforced. And there are circumstances where parties will negotiate a resolution of one or more loans where there's an agreement between the parties not to seek a money award to enforce a deficiency and so forth. And so in all these circumstances, we're looking to have the statute clarified to allow a foreclosure judgment to be entered without the entry of a money award. About 1840 or so across this country, one didn't have the ability to have a money award in a foreclosure action because of the distinction between courts of law and courts of equity. And statutes were enacted in most states during the early parts of the 1800s to allow, for the first time, a money judgment to be included in a foreclosure judgment. Oregon has a situation where the existing statute uses the word shall, and various courts are interpreting that to require the money award to be mandated in all circumstances. So this bill does not intend to change any of the circumstances under which a money award might or might not be permitted. It only clarifies that a money award is not required in all cases and provides that in a foreclosure action the amount of the debt is determined by the court and the judgment would include a determination of the amount of the debt. The sheriff would be able to conduct the sale and collect proceeds to satisfy that debt, just as the matters have always been conducted. The Dash 1 amendment that you have before you actually was a clarification requested by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, with whom the bar has worked closely in developing this statute to make sure that there would be no hiccup as far as the sheriffs are concerned in implementing foreclosure judgments. Be happy to answer any questions.
All right, any questions for Mr. Wade? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 368? Not seeing anyone wanting to, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing and we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 368. Looks like we need a motion on the Dash 1s.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 368.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 368. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 368 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 368 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Gelster, why don't you, if you'd be so kind to be our carrier on this one, that would be great. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 368, and we're going to be opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 370.
Laura? Yes, thank you. Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 370 was brought to us from the Oregon State Bar by the Family Law Section. More work is being done on this bill. There's amendments being worked out, so it is not ready to move today. Current Oregon law, however, states that payment of any death penalty under any public employer retirement plan that would otherwise be made to a person entitled to benefits under the plan shall be paid in whole or in part to an alternate payee if and to the extent expressly provided for in the terms of any court decree. There have been disputes regarding who qualifies as an alternate payee and a surviving spouse. So Senate Bill 370 allows certain death benefits to be paid to the former spouse of a public employer retirement plan member as provided in a judgment of annulment or dissolution of marriage or of separation. Additionally, it mandates that benefits be available to the former spouse after the effective date of any judgment of annulment or dissolution of marriage or of separation.
If I could, very simple question, but we're only talking about where there's documents saying that this will happen.
It would have to be the court decree.
Yes, okay.
All right.
I just don't want to see a fishing expedition. I have too many ex-wives. I don't want to go there.
All righty. We'll see if we can take care of that since we've got a couple more amendments coming in here. We have a number of people who are going to give testimony today, so I'm going to go ahead and ask Ryan, I believe it's Carty, and Clark Williams to please come forward. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Whoever would like to proceed, please just state your name for the record, and we'll await your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Carty. I am a lawyer in private practice here in Salem. My practice is exclusively limited to family law. Although I appear today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar in my capacity as the legislative liaison for the family law section of the bar, as well as the chair of the subcommittee on legislation on family law issues. Senate Bill 370 addresses two distinct statutes, ORS 237-600 and ORS 238-465, but it addresses just one singular issue. And I can explain that issue best by giving you an example. In most public retirement plans in Oregon, so you think about PERS, of course there's PERS Tier 1, Tier 2, OPSRP, there's judges' PERS, but that's a pretty small section. So let's talk about PERS Tier 1, Tier 2. In the context of a divorce, if the judge says, hey, these parties have been married for 20, 30 years, we've got one spouse who's a member of PERS, and so we're going to divide that PERS benefit equitably, and that's the magic word, because in Oregon, divorce is always an equitable process, meaning what's fair. So the judge says it's fair. In most cases, it's what's fair. There are those outliers. But so the judge says what's fair is we're going to divide this retirement benefit. But here's the issue. If the member dies before retirement, we're going to protect the non-member's benefit by giving that non-member what's called the survivor benefit. That means if the member dies, the non-member is still protected and is still going to receive some retirement benefits, and that's fair. That's what's gone on for years and years and years in Oregon. In fact, that's what ORS 237-600 and 238-465, part of the reason they were implemented 20 years ago. That's what they do. The issue is that with the implementation of OPSRP, and with the City of Portland's plans, the Court of Appeals has interpreted those statutes to say that if the member is not married at the time of death, then no retirement benefit exists, notwithstanding the court order. What that means is that if two spouses are divorced, and one is a longtime member, and the example I've given in my written testimony is a firefighter for the City of Portland, longtime firefighter, long-term marriage, the court says it's equitable to divide these retirement benefits. What happened, though, is just shy of retirement, the firefighter died. That meant the benefits went away entirely. Here's the anomaly. If that firefighter had remarried, doesn't matter who he remarries, doesn't have to remarry his former spouse, remarries anybody, those benefits all of a sudden rematerialize out of nowhere. And so it's like this magically disappearing, reappearing benefit that makes it difficult for courts to award in equitable situations, because this court, years previous in a divorce, says, hey, in order to put these people on footing that they need in order to move forward, I need to divide this retirement benefit in a fair manner. And what happens is then it goes away simply because of the member's marital status upon death. And that new spouse of the member may not get anything because we've already given it all away in the divorce, but it doesn't matter. It's that new spouse somehow triggers a benefit for the old spouse. That's an anomaly. All federal plans that are covered by ERISA, that's not possible. That type of dynamic would never occur in a federal plan that's covered by ERISA. It would never occur in a Tier 1 or Tier 2 plan because those benefits are protected. So what Senate Bill 370 aims to do is to protect that benefit that's always been there and to close this what the bar believes is sort of a loophole or just a donut hole in how benefits operate. And I'll close with one of the reasons this is a really big issue is divorce in Oregon, thank goodness, is no fault. And that means that neither spouse has to, well, one of the spouses doesn't have to want it. Clearly somebody wants it because they filed. But the non-filing spouse doesn't necessarily want to be divorced. And that means that benefits to which that spouse may have counted on and looked forward to for decades may disappear because of an involuntary process. There's no defense to a divorce. You can't put on the brakes and say, no thanks, I'd rather stay married. So what this does is it preserves a benefit. Courts are dividing and simply allows the court's authority to do what they've always done, which is divide those benefits in an equitable manner. I know I said I'd close on it. I've got to say one more thing. I'm a lawyer, so that happens quite
right.
A bit.
And it's our first week.
Okay, fair enough. But the one of the issues that's come up is whether this is a new benefit that's created. Our position is, of course, this is not a new benefit because any member of PERS who enters the system and is eligible for benefits, that is a benefit that is immediately available to that member. So it's a benefit that the system is counting on. And it's just this issue of this disappearing, reappearing sort of benefit that goes away and comes back issue. But it's a benefit that was always there. It's been there. It was there at the moment the member becomes eligible for benefits, and it should stay there, notwithstanding the divorce. Thank you.
Thank you. And Clark?
Yes, I'm Clark Williams. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem. I'm a pension lawyer and a business lawyer, but I do a lot of work with retirement plans and also draft retirement plan divisions, so-called quadros. I do a lot of those in my practice, including with PERS, and I've worked with PERS for many years, and in fact, I was part of that a group of on behalf of the State Bar 20 years ago, the draft what is now current, these current statutes, so I was part of that process 20 years ago. I'm just here to answer any questions, technical questions, if we get into the weeds a little bit about it. But again, we're trying to simply preserve a benefit that a former spouse, a current spouse, a member spouse, is entitled and has an expectation of receiving were the member to die and prevent that from magically disappearing on divorce. We want to provide that, that notwithstanding the divorce, a death benefit for a member who dies post-divorce before retirement is not lost for the spouse. And I'd like to say that as a pension lawyer, I can tell you that under ERISA, this is required of all private sector plans. What OPSERP and the City of Portland plan do now in terms of taking away that benefit upon divorce would be illegal in the federal system. And it's not even what the federal government plans provide. Civil service, FERS, military benefits provide for preserve survivor benefits for former spouses. And it's just, as far as I know, the City of Portland and OPSERP are the only two plans I'm aware of that actually divest a former spouse's entitlement to a survivor benefit upon a divorce. And so we're trying to just protect that.
All right, fine. So questions, technical questions. Senator Burdick first, but I just want to put on the record, I think Senator Cruz will want an answer as to fairness, is whether or not it's within the eye of the beholder.
Senator Burdick. I'm going to have a hard time following that. I think I was following along. The person gets divorced and then they die before their retirement age, then the benefit just goes away?
That's thank you, Senator Przanski and Senator Burdick. That's correct, and it's this small window because, and it's the non-member spouse that's affected. But it's a small window of time. It's between the divorce and retirement age. Now, if the member spouse makes it to retirement age, and then dies, then the non-member spouse receives a benefit. And again, that's where there's all these things where it's sort of a disappearing, reappearing benefit. If you make it to retirement age, you're fine. If the member spouse remarries, then the non-member spouse is fine. It's simply if...
Now, that's where I got confused.
Okay.
Supposing they remarry and then die before retirement, what happens then?
Then the non-member spouse is protected by virtue... I'm telling you, this doesn't make sense. No, if the member spouse remarries someone new in the future, then it revitalizes and brings back this benefit that used to exist in the past. It doesn't make any sense.
Boy, I'll say... Thank you.
So just clarification, when you say the benefit goes away, we're speaking exclusively for the non-member in the sense of whatever has been accrued by the member is still going to be there within that estate.
That's correct.
Okay. Senator Cruz, you have a follow-up?
It's in the estate. I'm not quite sure I fully understand that. Okay.
I guess what I'm saying is that once the member has accrued, that benefit stays with them. In the sense
well, it stays with them, but if they die, does that become part of the estate? I mean, that benefit can't roll on to dependents, I wouldn't think.
Well, it would, but through the estate or probate.
Senator Przanski and Senator Cruz, may I clarify that? In OPSERP and in the City of Portland plan, if the member dies before retirement, the member has no benefit at all. They didn't make it to retirement. There's no retirement benefit. All that's available is a death benefit for a spouse under the terms of the plan. And we're trying, in this case, to make sure that death benefit can be preserved for a former spouse should they get divorced before he dies.
Okay, but one more question, and not necessarily all that relevant. Okay, so the member gets divorced, and let's say he's getting the benefit before he dies, and so that spouse is getting whatever was in the court decree, what percentage. Okay, let's say the member did not get divorced. Does that spouse, upon his death, still get the full benefit or just a portion of it?
Senator Przanski and Senator Cruz, if I can just maybe use an example to illustrate this. Let's assume that a member in OPSERP has entitled to $1,000 a month at retirement. Everything's defined in terms of dollars per month. Now, had they stay married all the way to retirement, that benefit would be paid in the form of a joint and survivor annuity, which is $1,000 a month to the member. And then if the member dies still married, $500 a month, 50%. To the spouse for as long as the spouse lives. That's the basic benefit in OPSERP. Now, let's say they get divorced before retirement. Again, the benefit itself, the retirement benefit can be protected and divided. So we'd say $500 to him and $500 to her. And if the member, if they both survive to retirement age, the PERS will pay each of them separately $500 a month. Her benefit would be adjusted for different life expectancy, but other than that, that benefit's paid and protected. And in a divorce court, we can do that, no problem. And if the member dies after retirement, that does not affect her rights. She gets her own separate annuity for her lifetime, so that's not a problem. The problem is if he dies before retirement and they're still married, the $1,000 a month goes away, but under OPSERP, this is $500 a month pre-retirement survivor benefit, a 50% survivor benefit. So again, dying before retirement, the spouse is going to get $500 a month. But the way the law is interpreted now by OPSERP is that if they get divorced and then he dies, her $500 goes away. There's nothing paid to anybody. She's out of luck. And that's what we're trying to protect.
Sounds fair, huh?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
So how often does this happen?
Not too often, Senator. It requires a certain sequence of events that they are married, they get divorced, he doesn't remarry, and then the member dies before retirement without remarrying. As Ryan explained, the law has been interpreted to say that there has to be a spouse, some spouse, to have a survivor benefit. So if marries spouse number two, magically the survivor benefit reappears, and the divorce decree provides for the spouse number one to receive it, it'll be reinstated at that point. So we have this appearing, disappearing, reappearing survivor benefit for a former spouse.
Senator Cruz.
Okay. One more confusion here. Okay. The member doesn't get divorced, and let's say they're receiving the benefit, they die, their spouse gets half of whatever it was. Okay. The member gets divorced, and in the divorce decree, his ex-spouse, let's say they were to get 75% of it for some reason, and then they die, does that, so realistically, that divorced former spouse could actually get more, or does it drop down to that 50% at that point?
It would be 50% of 75% probably in that situation.
Okay.
Seems fair, huh? Any other questions, comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
With your testimony.
Divorce has always confused me, Floyd. So
I understand.
Okay.
So I have Marjorie Taylor, Stephanie Vaughn, and I'm going to go ahead and ask Elizabeth Edwards, since we have three chairs. Why don't the three of you come up? While they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 370? All right. So I'm going, just on the order of signing up, I've got Marjorie and Stephanie in one block, and then Elizabeth. So however y'all want to present, I understand everyone here looks like they're taking a neutral position.
Certainly. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, Senior Policy Director at PERS. And as has been explained, PERS believes this is a new benefit and has been stated before. Currently, an ex-spouse of an OPSERT member who dies pre-retirement is currently not due a benefit according to ORS 238-230. Again, we believe this is a new benefit. It will increase cost to the system. And we do have a couple of clarifications that we're seeking, and we would be happy to work with the bar on those if you choose to move forward. And again, those include who the benefit would be paid to if the member has an ex-spouse but then is remarried, who does the benefit go to? What happens in the cases of domestic partnerships and dissolved domestic partnerships? We would seek some clarification on that. We also seek clarification on the effective date of the measure to make sure that this applies to divorces after the effective date, not necessarily the benefits themselves and how they're accrued. And then recently, the state bar acknowledged that our administrative fee that PERS charges for administering divorce decrees was established in 1993. It's $300 as set in statute, and they've acknowledged that perhaps that doesn't cover the cost of doing business, and we'd be happy to talk with them about increasing that. I do have Stephanie Vaughn here who can answer some of your questions about how we process the divorce decrees and the impact to the OPSERT members.
All right. So you're here for the Q&A
yes.
section?
Yes.
All right. So why don't we go ahead and I'm going to have Elizabeth, why don't you go ahead and give your testimony, then we'll open up the panel for questions.
Thank you, Senator Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Edwards with the City of Portland and the Portland Fire, Police, and Disability Retirement Fund. You've heard a little bit about our fund. I think I'll describe it. City Charter designates that there are two types of people eligible for death benefits under our Fire and Police Disability Fund, and it's a surviving spouse and a dependent minor child. Surviving spouse is defined as someone who the member was legally married to for the preceding year and from whom the member was not judicially separated or divorced. So that's how we get into this situation of the right exists when there's a spouse and the right currently doesn't exist when there's not a spouse. We are neutral on SB 370 and think that if the legislature decides to move forward and provide for a death benefit payable to a former spouse in this limited case where a member dies before reaching the age of eligibility for retirement, that there are one or two additional amendments to the bill that would be needed to clarify that, and we've been working with the bar. Basically, we would be looking for an amendment to ORS 237-620 and amend it in a similar way as Section 1 of this bill does for OPSERP, looking at making sure that it's clear that a former spouse in the definition for it would include a former spouse in the definition of spouse or surviving spouse for this limited case only. And we've shared that language and are working through issues with the bar. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
All righty. Thank you. Questions? Chair has a couple of questions. I guess I'm going to, first one, I just want to follow up, and this is more to PERS. So Marjorie or Stephanie, the number of new benefits you think this might create, give me a ballpark, and we understand it doesn't happen too often, so I'm just trying to figure out how many you think would be projected.
Chair Przanski, first of all, OPSERP is the only program that's open to new membership, and that's growing every day. They are correct in stating that this doesn't happen very often, but that's right now. And, of course, moving into the future, we have no way to identify how often this will happen. As Stephanie will probably acknowledge, we do not track marital status of our members until a benefit is applied for, whether it's a death benefit or a retirement benefit. So at this point, we don't know how many people are single, how many people are married, how many people are going to divorce or remarry anytime before they die or apply for a retirement benefit, or we just aren't sure how many people. I'd say it's probably less than 100 per year. Isn't that what we've heard? No, Stephanie might have additional information.
Good morning. For the record, Stephanie Vaughn with PERS. As Marjorie said, we don't track marital status. The only time we ask for marital status is at the time of death or divorce, or death or retirement. We know how many OPSERP members die each year because we do pay out pre-retirement benefits from the individual account program. We also know how many of those are married at the time of death because we do pay out the benefits from the OPSERP pension program. And that's what we base the cost of the system on, is our past experience paying out those death benefits, not upon the current marital status of our members.
All right. So I guess I'm puzzled as to this, let's say, increasing the cost. I guess conceptually I understand if you increase the pool of potential individuals that may be getting a benefit, there's work to be done. But what I'm hearing is at this point we do not know as PERS how many people are in the system, that are going to, how it's going to be paid out based on whether there's a divorce or some type of other resolution where a non-member is going to receive portion of the benefits that's due to the member. Is that correct?
Chair Przanski, yes, we don't know how many will. We do know, though, that this does, we will be paying out benefits that under the current statute we would not otherwise be paying.
But we don't know how many that is. Yeah. It's just in an abstract. Okay.
And
Senator Burdick.
My apologies. I think this was covered, but am I to understand that this only, that this does not affect Tier 1 and Tier 2?
Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, that's correct. This applies only to OPSERP members, the current membership, the newest membership.
Right. And so I guess it would, in a sense, for someone that's in the Tier 1, Tier 2 that is was rolled over and that has that separate benefit. It's my understanding when we went through the PERS changes that everyone that was in 1 and 2 actually went into the, or not.
And Chair Przanski, I would echo what my colleagues said about, it's our understanding at the city that it would likely increase our costs, but we haven't run the actuarial analysis on that. But we're comfortable if the legislature decides to move forward with this particular policy change.
Okay.
And to clarify, Chair Przanski, anyone who was a Tier 1 member before 2003 remains Tier 1.
Right.
Anyone Tier 2 before 2003 is Tier 2. Anyone after 2003 is OPSERP. However, there's the individual account program that all members are part of. And that's the benefit that is paid out to any OPSERP member, any ex-spouse, spouse, pre-retirement, post-retirement. Anyway, everybody has access to the IAP.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification.
Yep.
Other questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. As I asked, and I didn't see anyone, but I'll ask once again, is there anyone else now who would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 370? Not seeing any. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 370. As Council said, we are not ready to move forward on this bill that does need some additional work. I am encouraging all of those who are participants and active interest in this to be getting together and working together and coming up with whatever amendments. The chair at this point is, let's say, willing to, let's say, continue our discussions and moving forward. It appears that there's an inequity here that we do want to try to address, but I understand that we may see other reasons why it may not be beneficial at this point. The amendments that are needs to be done, I want everyone to be working together. And if there's an issue with that, getting everyone together, please let me know, and we'll see about getting beyond that. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up a informational hearing on the Department of Corrections. And Colette Peters, our director of the Department of Corrections, is here to give us an overview. And Colette, is there anyone else you'd like to bring up? Feel free to do so. Thank you for being here. Sorry that you were not able to join us in our venture to Angola State Prison.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. It's good to be here this morning. For the record, I'm Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections. It sounds like you had a very informative trip, so I'm looking forward to debriefing with you further.
That'd be great.
Okay. So I'm pleased to be able to provide an overview of the Department of Corrections. I have now been the director of this agency for 3 years and was fortunate enough to inherit a well-run organization, and we've worked hard over the last 3 years to even make improvements to the system. I'll first start with our mission. So the mission of the Oregon Department of Corrections is to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of criminal behavior. Thank you so much. Thank you. So we've worked hard over the years to really refine the work behind this mission, but I think it's important to note that holding offenders accountable is simply more than carrying out the court's orders and removing offenders from society for a prescribed length of time. It is also that second half of our mission, which is to reduce the likelihood that individuals will commit another crime after release. And that is so important, because what that means for me is that when they leave our care and custody, another victim is not created if we've done our job correctly. Here you'll see our agency organization chart. This provides just a high-level overview of our organization. Our team is made up of about 4,500 employees scattered across the state, most of who fall into one of these five divisions. We also have seven work units outside of these divisions who report directly to the director's office. All of our divisions really work together to create the work of the Department of Corrections. This is your second largest general funded state agency. As I said, we have 4,500 employees. We have 14,500 adults in our custody. We have 14 institutions across the state of Oregon. We have 32,000 offenders on community supervision. The 13-15 biennial budget was $1.4 billion. And I think it's important to remember that our population is not stagnant. We admit about 5,000 new intakes every year and release 45 offenders per year. If we look closer at those on community corrections supervision, you'll see that layout here in this pie chart. The department either has direct or indirect responsibility over those 32,000 offenders on community supervision. We operate both Douglas and Linn County Community Corrections. This slide shows you the proportional split between those individuals who are in supervision because of probation, post-prison supervision, parole, or if they're on local control. Like the rest of the nation, The majority of offenders in our custody are men. They make up about 91% of our prison population. Yet, while women make up just 9% of the inmate population, the female population is rising. In fact, since July 2011, our female population has grown by over 14%, compared to just a 3% growth of our male population. So, unfortunately, as a nation, the number of women in prison is increasing much faster than men, so it's not just a phenomenon in Oregon. The good news, as we talk about public safety reform and House Bill 3194, we were able to temper this growth. Pre-3194, we were projected to have over 1,400 women in our custody over the next 10 years. Post-3194, we were able to decrease that projection by 6%. This provides a breakdown of the types of offenses that result in individuals being sent to the Department of Corrections. This chart reflects that 67% of those that come to us having committed a person-to-person offense. When you look more closely at those crimes, more than a quarter of our population is incarcerated due to sex crimes. Again, like the rest of the country, our population is aging. While the percentage of those younger than 30 is actually showing a decline, those over 45 are growing rapidly. We've seen an increase of 34% in those 46 and older since just 2006. As you can imagine, this has a profound impact on our cost of health care. Those 61 and older are actually our highest cost group, and those 18 to 24 are our least cost. As you can imagine, because of the lifestyle that these individuals have lived prior to coming to the Department of Corrections, the fact that they've lacked a lot of the preventive care, an offender is actually 10 years older biologically than their chronological age. So their health impact is very compounded.
Well, before we go further on, back on the age, I understand that we're seeing the demographics are showing that our age of our offenders are increasing. Are they new intakes that are coming in that are older, or is just because of our sentencing structure that they are staying longer and they're now going into the demographics of showing a population base of an older segment based on the term of sentence they're serving?
Thank you, Chair Przanski. It's both, but the latter is more impactful. So I would say there is an impact in the sex offender population, because while you age out of breaking into houses and stealing cars, unfortunately you don't age out of sex offending. But the latter is more profound. It is that length of stay. I'll share an interesting statistic with you. I had the privilege of watching a 1988 City Club of Portland speech by then Director Michael Franke. And it was fascinating to me. And we talked about the number of intakes that the Department of Corrections currently receives today, which is about 400 intakes a month. And we release about 400 a month because we flatlined that population. In 1988, we received 350 intakes a month. We had 4,600 adults in custody then. We have 14,500 now.
Interesting.
So it's definitely the length of stay that's making this impact. Again, unfortunately, like the rest of the nation, Oregon has a disproportionate number of minorities in our criminal justice system. African Americans comprise about 3% of Oregon's population, yet they comprise about 9% of our prison population. Hispanics comprise 11% of Oregon's population, and it increases slightly in our prison population to 13%. And while American Indians comprise approximately 3% of the prison population, they are incarcerated at a rate three times that of the population in Oregon. Over the years, our agency has become the largest mental health care provider in the state. Approximately 70% of the adults in our custody have some mental health need. While keeping them safe, our staff safe, and other adults in custody safe, our philosophy really around behavioral health is really about engaging those adults in custody to teach them to take responsibility for their own health care, including their mental health care, so that they will be better prepared upon release. So while they're with us, we really view this environment as an opportunity for them to practice how to manage their mental health systems and engage in activities of daily living. That includes the basic, simple hygiene, learning how to sleep appropriately, which isn't easy in a prison environment, eating well, and regularly managing their medications. This is part of self-management, and that's really what we're trying to accomplish, is a health engagement model. So while you all are talking about CCOs out in the community, we really are trying to act like one inside the Department of Corrections. Now, the same high need is true as it relates to substance abuse. A large portion of our population is diagnosed with substance abuse issues and would benefit from alcohol and drug treatment services. Unfortunately, the department does not have the capacity or the resources to offer treatment to all those who need it. So our offender population, what we do is we really focus on prioritizing. We look at those with a high need for treatment coupled with a high risk to reoffend and really target those individuals for that substance abuse treatment. Now, I've shared a lot of the complexities inside the Department of Corrections and with our inmate population. So given all of these complexities, what works? We know so much more about what works in corrections now than we did 20 years ago, and this is an agency really committed to relying on research to manage our programs. So we know that the most effective way to reduce future criminal behavior is to provide adults in custody with the right combination of treatment, job preparation, education, and visitation, and not necessarily in that priority order. In general, research tells us that punishment without correctional treatment does not reduce recidivism. So you can't just send them to prison and hope for a better outcome. We have to do something with them while they're there. We also know that putting offenders with a low risk to recidivate into programs does not reduce recidivism. So that's why we have to target that high-risk offender with the high need for treatment. We also know that effective programs must focus on known criminal risk factors. Now, I'd like to talk about performance management. This is something I'm really pleased of the progress that we're making at the Department of Corrections. We're working diligently to turn this organization into one that's managing a performance-based management system, which we hope will help us become more effective, but also more transparent to all of you and the rest of our stakeholders as to how this organization is being run. So after over the last 3 years, we have been working on implementing this performance-based management system. We've named the system CORE, which stands for Correctional Outcomes Through Research and Engagement. We started with a full review of our organization. So we looked at every business process inside the organization, and we've mapped the organization. You actually have a copy of that map as one of our handouts. And then we began looking at setting targets for all of our operations, everything from how many medication errors do we have every month, how long does it take an IT request to move through the system, to how we're actually doing as it relates to recidivism and inmate on staff assaults. Then we've set targets, and we're actually measuring those outcomes. So the organization has now engaged in 5 quarterly target reviews, so really trying to operate this organization like we would if it was a private sector organization. And we've seen dramatic improvement. And by improvement, I would say couple of areas that I would highlight are around budget efficiencies. So it has allowed us to take data points that we've been proud of for years, like our food costs. We operate our organization by providing 3 meals a day to inmates at about $2.34 a day, something we were very proud of. This process asked us to go down deeper into the system and look at food costs institution by institution, and we learned that some institutions were dramatically higher than that 2.34 and others were lower. So we spent some time trying to figure out the why behind that, and even further the progress in that food purchasing and food delivery. Another example that I'm most proud of is around employee engagement. This has allowed that frontline officer to step forward and share with us through this process what they've noticed hasn't been working for 20 years and really push forward that problem in a way where we could solve it. So it's really not just a performance-based management system, but we're trying to improve even the culture inside the organization. I mentioned earlier that the 13-15 biennial budget was $1.4 billion. Now I will highlight the governor's balanced budget for 15-17. This chart shows an overview of that budget, which includes $1.6 billion in total funds for the department and just about 4,500 FTE. This chart also shows how our budget total is broken down by division and major program areas. So you can see that the bulk of our budget goes to three distinct program areas. No surprise, 45% of our budget goes to our operations division. That's the division responsible for all of our prison operations. 16% of our budget is allocated for community corrections and health services. Community corrections at 16%, and health services is at 15%. You'll also see, again, no surprise, that the bulk of our staff is in the operations division at 73%. If you add the health services component of that division to that number, it increases to 85% of our staff. Finally, you will notice that 95.7% of our funding is from the general fund. So with that, that concludes my presentation and overview of the agency, and I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Great, thank you. Questions? Looks like you're off the hook.
Wow,
thank
easy
you.
On me today. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
You bet. So we'll go ahead and close the informational hearing on the Department of Corrections. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 232. And Jeff, why don't you give us an overview?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 232 authorizes the Department of Corrections to apply for grants or other financial support for reentry services and establishes a Department of Corrections subaccount for funding received. Funding is continuously appropriated in a subaccount for reentry support and services. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and ask. We have two people that have listed for witnesses today. Kim, why don't you come up, and Mary, why don't you join her? While they're coming up, is there going to be anyone else that might want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 232? All right. So, Kim, I'm going to let you start off since it is a more of a department bill.
Great. Chair Brzezinski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm Kim Brokamp. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 232 and answer any questions you have. Senate Bill 232, as you heard, would establish statutory authority for the Department of Corrections to receive and expend grant funds on reentry support and services for offenders releasing from the department to supervision to the community. A little background, during the last 2 years in my previous position as the Assistant Director of the Offender Management Rehabilitation Division, which was in charge of programs for inmates through intake through release, we started to explore additional reentry grants that we could potentially apply for to assist offenders as they left our custody and went into the community corrections world. What we recognized at that time is we didn't have statutory authority to expend funds on inmates who released from the Department of Corrections and were then on community supervision. So with this lack of statutory authority, many of the reentry grants that are out there are what they call wraparound services. They want to start with people in custody, and they want to continue with those people into the community on supervision. And what it really means is a partner or some kind of subcontract with someone in the community, a nonprofit or someone to apply those reentry funds. So without the statutory authority to expend those funds, since we would be the primary grantee, we ran into a spot. So This bill would essentially provide us that statutory authority. And just so you're clear, those reentry services we talk about, housing, vocational assistance, medication, transportation, access to physical and mental health services, those are all the things those reentry dollars would allow us to do, counseling, alcohol and drug treatment continued, so in specialized supervision strategies. So really, the bill gives us a statutory authority to partner and provide best reentry. Department's very proud of our recidivism rate and the efforts we do around reentry. The Governor's Reentry Council is another important factor that's helping us look at some of this stuff. So Senate Bill 232 would provide us ability to do better work. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Great. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Move the microphone just to make certain we get it. There you go. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing AFSCME Council 75. And we're here in support of Senate Bill 232. As you know, the best way to lower prison population is to make sure that when folks finish their sentence, they don't come back. And this gives the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections yet another tool in their toolbox in assisting a successful transition back to the community for inmates as they complete their sentences. And you know, we're all about, our union is all about making successful changes in people's lives, and this would be yet another example of a good wraparound service for folks that most people don't really want to think much about. And you know, we all know that everybody in prison is at some point probably going to get out. And if we can make that transition a positive one and a successful one, then it's better for everybody involved. And we're here to support the department in their effort to get this bill passed and expand their authority to do grants with community corrections programs. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions? So just from the chair's perspective, what this will actually do is allow the department to use these funds, actually, I guess, apply for grants that they're not able to do now and take them to programs such as here in Marion County would be through the Sheriff's Office, if I'm not mistaken. In Eugene, I know that we have sponsors, which is a nonprofit that does this reentry work. And it is, I think, as Mary Bachman has said, you know, virtually everyone is coming out. 90 to 95% of the individuals that go in are going to be coming out. And so the question is, what services do we provide them so they can actually integrate back into communities and not having issues that it's going to cause recidivism and more victimization? So I understand we're not able to move the bill today because we're waiting for the fiscal.
Okay.
So we'll, when the fiscal comes in, we'll have this
for a work session.
For work session.
Yeah.
And I guess, Jeff, do we know, have any anticipation of when that might be done?
Hopefully shortly. However, I think the best thing to do would be to just schedule a work session next week.
All right. So I was going to see if we wanted to leave it open
it's
for tomorrow.
No-brainer, so.
So we'll just wait until we get it back and we'll just get it on the
we're
schedule.
Still first week for it.
I understand that. Well, we're warming up, you know. Some people, you know, they forget that, you know, the hare and the tortoise on the marathon.
Yeah,
we're going to take the marathon approach. All these other committees are going to be pretty dog tired before the end of the first week. All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Chair, can I just say welcome to your two new members?
Yes, you may.
You know, it's nice to Representative Gelser, or Senator Gelser, it is nice to have you in my world now. And welcome aboard. I look forward to working with all of you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
I should just, for formality, is there anyone else who does want to give testimony on Senate Bill 232? Not seeing any, we'll go ahead and close that public hearing. And I believe that takes care of the work we have for today. We'll be back here tomorrow at 8:30, and with that, we're adjourned. Thank you. Back here tomorrow at 8:30, and with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.